Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Through 45 presidents and more than two centuries, the United States Congress has held a grand total of two impeachment trials. Richard Nixon counts as a near-miss third trial, resigning in August 1974 for fear of being convicted. Now comes a newly elected Democratic Congress, taking office next month as an investigation into President Trump stirs renewed questions about the possibility of impeachment. Few people can offer better insight on that possibility than David Priest. He served in the CIA during the Clinton and George W. Bush administrations, where his roles included delivering intelligence briefings to then-FBI Director Robert Mueller. That's the same Robert Mueller now leading the investigation into Russian interference in the U.S. elections and possible involvement by the Trump administration. David Priest is also an expert on the presidency and national security, subjects that intertwine in his latest book. It's called How to Get Rid of a President: History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives. David Priest, in town as part of his book tour, joins me today in studio. David, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Hi, Eric. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, it's great to have you here. And before we get to the new book, I want to ask you about your first book.
Sure.
It was about presidents and daily intelligence briefings, how they receive that information, what they do with it. And the foreword happened to be written by President George Herbert Walker Bush, who is very much on the minds of all Americans right now. So if you don't mind, take us through how that relationship developed for you while you were with the CIA.
Thanks, Eric. It's been a difficult week for many of us. I did not know President Bush as president or as vice president. I was too young. I was not in the mix. It was after he left his presidency that I briefed him as a CIA officer. CIA still will brief ex-presidents on occasion when they're traveling overseas and things like that. So I did have the chance to meet him then and was impressed by him. I had already known, of course, of his reputation as a former director of Central Intelligence, as well as a former president and vice president. But then when I started to write this book on the history of presidential intelligence, I reached out to his office to see if he would be willing to offer some memories and some stories, and he jumped at the chance. And he volunteered to not only contribute to the book, but also to introduce me to others, including all of the other living former presidents who contributed to the book in terms of stories and interviews, but also to write the foreword for the book. And in typical George Bush style, he did not use the foreword to pat himself on the back and write about what a good user of intelligence he was. He used it to thank the people in the intelligence community who are nameless, many of whom remain so, who provided him the intelligence he needed to help liberate Kuwait from Iraq, to help end the Cold War without a shot being fired. He used it, again, it's his style, he used it to reach out to give credit to others who don't often get it. And I thought that's the kind of man we were celebrating the life of.
Now, I wanted to ask you a little bit about George H.W. Bush, because on your Twitter feed, you had a series of posts, I think it was about 15 of them, and you trace your relationship with him, starting with when you didn't even know him. You were a young man, and you were, I guess, helping him out with his campaign in Illinois. Is that right?
Yes, it was his presidential campaign. He was coming through Central Illinois, which not all candidates do in every election cycle. But for a young man interested in politics in Central Illinois, this was quite a thing for me to see the vice president of the United States running for president coming through, and I got to contribute in a very, very small way to one of the local events, and it did get me interested in politics, also got me interested in this man and what he stood for, and even though that was now several decades ago, I'm proud to say that all of my experiences with him since then have reinforced the notion that this was just a good man who happened to be president.
Well, and we are, as I said, we're going to get to the new book because there's a lot of stuff I want to talk about. But one other question that I have to ask you about, I believe you were at the funeral. Maybe you could give us a little firsthand perspective on what it was like to be in the room.
The service at the National Cathedral was a remarkable event. It was thousands of people, all of whom had a connection to George Bush. And the funny thing was, it did not feel like thousands of people. It felt like a room of friends. And all of the stories being shared before the service began and after it ended were very much in the same theme, which is talking about how this man had reached out and made people feel like they were part of the family, even though they weren't. He may have the largest family in the United States because he brought people in that way. The other thing that sticks with me is the fact that many people saw this watching the event live on television or seeing clips afterwards. But when George W. Bush, his son, delivered one of the eulogies, he was getting through it as well as he could. And then at the end, as soon as he was talking about his father, just as a father, it was not a president talking about another president. It was a son speaking about his loving late father. And when he broke down, there was not a dry eye in the house.
Well, it's hard to transition from that, but we'll try to. Again, we're speaking with David Preece, and the book that he is out promoting right now is called How to Get Rid of a President, History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives. I can't imagine where you might have gotten the inspiration for this.
Actually, there is a story there. The first book I wrote was called The President's Book of Secrets, and it was the history of the President's Intelligence Report. And generally, the stories in that book are stories of presidents doing well, presidents who are taking intelligence, using it to help inform national security decisions. And there's a bunch of details in there that are a lot of fun. But generally, it's about presidents doing their job and doing it well. And I felt like I needed to balance myself a little bit because this book is largely about the history of presidents who didn't do so well and in some cases drove people to try to push them out of office, whether at the polls or through more extraordinary means.
And I think you've said elsewhere that Donald Trump's campaign in part inspired this or made you think about this issue, and then you broadened it from there.
Absolutely. In 2016, when the first book came out, I was looking for what am I going to write about next? And I learned so much about the presidents writing the first book that I knew I wanted to learn more about the presidents before the Central Intelligence Agency existed, which was largely the overlap in the first book. I wanted to learn about all those 19th century presidents that we might know some of their names, but we really don't know what they did. So I started researching it and quickly came up with the fact that we study a lot about presidential elections, and even famous ones in history are still in our cultural imagination. We learn a little bit about what presidents did in office and their great accomplishments. But the thing that makes us unique as a country is we have a systematic way of getting rid of presidents. Every 4 years, we can vote them out. And even if that's not good enough, we have other constitutional ways and other political ways of removing or otherwise sidelining presidents. And yet, I hadn't seen a book covering all of that. I heard people in the election campaign and even after the election already talking about words like impeachment and things like that. But I didn't see somebody writing about all of the ways that presidents leave office. So I decided to be the person to pull them together and find all the good stories to put into a book.
And you've done a nice job of synthesizing a lot of information. The book reads very quickly. You're detailed without getting bogged down. I want to ask you about one of the things you write in this book about the Founding Fathers and the Constitution. You write, quote, "Their original solutions are neither flawless nor eternal. So if the paths to get rid of a president fail to meet the needs of the nation, we can mobilize our representatives to revise or add to them," end quote. Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting concept. And I'm wondering, what are the odds you think of that happening? That is, the idea of revision or changes.
Well, we have one good example in recent history, which is in the 1960s. The Congress got together and they got all the states to ratify a constitutional amendment, the 25th Amendment, which codified the succession mechanism for a president who leaves office and put in a mechanism for getting rid of a president who is disabled. And that's something that was held back from Americans earlier because there was not a process in place to make that happen. So we're capable of doing it. And if there is national momentum saying we don't like something that's going on, well, guess what? We have a system that allows us to change our laws. It requires input at multiple levels. It's not easy to do. Otherwise, we would have hundreds of amendments instead of 20-some. But we can do it, and we have done it, even on an issue like removing a president. So there's no reason that that system couldn't work again if we find that other methods that are out there don't work for us.
So I mentioned at the beginning that as of January, we'll have a Democratic majority House, probably led by Nancy Pelosi. We'll have a 53-47 Republican majority in the Senate, led by Mitch McConnell. If the Democrats vote to impeach Trump, how difficult do you think it would be to convince two-thirds of the Senate to convict him?
It would be extraordinarily difficult, even if those numbers were switched. Even if it were 53 or 54 Democrats, that's still not two-thirds. And probably not all Democrats would vote to convict the president. We saw that back in the case long ago of Andrew Johnson in the 1860s. There was a two-thirds Republican majority, and they still did not convict. It's hard, and it's supposed to be hard. The founders were not stupid. They did not want presidents getting impeached and removed every other election cycle. They wanted the voters to decide as often as possible, rather than have it through this extraordinary method. It is there for that break the glass scenario where you really need to use the emergency method. And certainly they shouldn't be hesitant to do so if they feel that it gets to that. But it is going to be hard to get that two-thirds conviction vote, and it should be.
I thought one of the things that was interesting that you explore with the Andrew Johnson example is the fact that part of the motivation to acquit him was because they knew, the Republicans knew, they had Ulysses S. Grant as a candidate, and he was all but a lock to win, so their problem would be solved soon enough, in essence.
That's right. It's a major factor in impeachment. We tend to think it's all about the senators putting on their constitutional steward hats and weighing the evidence and deciding whether the president met the conditions of treason, bribery, or high crimes and misdemeanors, which are the three categories in the Constitution allowing impeachment and removal. And that is a part of it. That is one of the things they do. But one of the other things my research showed me is they're also looking ahead, saying, if we remove the president, what comes next? And if we have a better chance within months in the Johnson case, but certainly within years, if we have a better chance of getting someone in the White House who is more likely to be fit for the presidency and uphold the laws of the country, well, maybe we just wait it out. Maybe we take our chances that it won't be as bad as we think, and we take the more sure thing coming up. Absent such a sure thing, then it becomes more likely that they would vote to convict and remove.
So spin that forward for me. If you look at this situation, if something happens with Donald Trump and he ends up being impeached, what might be the political calculus? As you said, it would be difficult no matter what, but right. What might be the political calculus that would push some senators who may be on the fence to say, you know what, let's leave this alone and let matters play out?
It's going to be a few things, Eric. First of all, I think it does matter what the accusations are. It does matter what the crimes are. In the case of Andrew Johnson, one of the articles of impeachment was basically, not these words, but very close, the president is out there in public saying nasty things about Congress. Well, they did not come close to removing him on that charge, and that is not what the founders meant for impeachment. On the other hand, when you had Andrew Johnson, Bill Clinton, and Richard Nixon with articles of impeachment drawn up in two of those three cases, voted on, talking about abuse of power, obstruction of justice, suborning perjury, these are more serious crimes. And if evidence of those things is tight enough, then you could start to see some of that happen. But I think it does have to be mixed with a couple of other things. One is who follows him directly into office, not the next election, like Ulysses S. Grant following Andrew Johnson.
The vice president.
But who would the vice president be? Back in the days of Andrew Johnson, there was no vice president. He had been the vice president, came in when Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, and they did not yet have a mechanism for picking a new vice president. So there was no one in that office, and they would have had a senator that nobody wanted in office fulfilling the role of the presidency. Right now, it would be Mike Pence. And while I don't see a lot of Democrats excited about Mike Pence, I don't think they see him in the same way that they see Donald Trump in terms of how different he is than past presidents. And then, of course, you look ahead to the next election and you say, what's likely to happen if Donald Trump is running against a reasonable Democrat who might pull some conservatives who are upset about Donald Trump not following traditional conservative philosophy? You might have a better chance of just waiting him out, even if you think that he's unfit for the office.
And we hope you'll wait us out. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be back with David Priest. We're talking about how to get rid of a president, which is a very self-explanatory title. You're listening to Charlotte Talks here on WFAE.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks with Eric Spanberg, I'm in for Mike Collins. My guest today is David Preece. He's the author of the new book, How to Get Rid of a President, History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives. And we were talking about some of the political calculations that might go into a decision on President Trump if impeachment becomes an issue. But right before that, you mentioned high crimes and misdemeanors. I was going to read the impeachment clause in the Constitution from Article 2, Section 4. You're very familiar with this. And it reads, quote, "The president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors." That obviously, as you explore in the book, could encompass many things. But in the case of Trump and the Mueller investigation, what do you think is likely to qualify and what isn't?
It's very unclear what high crimes and misdemeanors really means. Even at the time they were working on it at the Constitutional Convention of 1787, they essentially just settled on this language. Everybody nodded. They moved on. They didn't explore exactly what it meant. Over time, and I interviewed some constitutional scholars for this to try to get their insights, it appears that high crimes and misdemeanors, the high refers to matters of state. That is, if the president of the United States walked into a Food Lion and, you know, grabbed some candy on his way out, of course, he's violating the law. But he's not affecting the fabric of the country. He's not affecting governance itself. That high crimes and misdemeanors appears to have to do something with the act of being president, the act of governance in the country. That's probably why Bill Clinton, who was impeached, was not removed, because senators voting on it said, yes, he did some bad things. He committed perjury. He definitely seemed to be obstructing justice by encouraging people not to cooperate and speak truthfully in the investigation. But why was he doing it? He wasn't doing it to further his own growth of power as president. He was doing it to cover up a private affair. And perhaps that's why they didn't see it as quite the high crime and misdemeanor that some of the others who voted on it did. So in the case of Trump, I think it will depend in large part what comes out of the special counsel investigation. If there is more detail than we have now, which is almost certain from the testimony of people like his attorney, Michael Cohen, from the former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, who have been cooperating fully with Mueller. When that information comes out, either in future indictments or in some kind of a report, that will give evidence of whether or not the president was committing something that could be called high crimes and misdemeanors. We don't know what that looks like yet, but the kinds of things they are supposed to be looking at and the kinds of things that have come out that they are investigating sure look like they have to do with obstruction of justice and abuse of power, which have been used in articles of impeachment before as high crimes and misdemeanors.
Now, I know I'm zigzagging here. I'm taking you through a lot of time travel, but that's part of the book's journey as well. Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you, you write about James Madison opposing the role of the Senate in deciding impeachment trials. What was so concerning to Madison about that aspect of impeachment?
It's funny, during that, looking at the debates of the Constitutional Convention of 1787, it's amazing how quickly they move through a lot of these issues. And they would raise quick objections to something without necessarily fully explaining what they objected to. One of the concerns Madison had, and actually several of the delegates had, on the one hand, they didn't want a strong chief executive that could become a king. They were fighting against a king. They did not want to have a president so strong that the president could abuse the rights of the people. On the other hand, they realized pretty quickly that, you need to have a strong enough executive to actually do the job. By that point, we'd been operating for a few years as a country under the Articles of Confederation, and they were notoriously weak, and the chief executive wasn't able to function. So they were balancing that in and out, both for things like the powers of the presidency and what do we do with him once he's there. So they wanted the president to not be always fearing removal by the Senate, because they didn't want the president to be a creature of the Senate. They didn't want it to be essentially a confidence vote every time they didn't like a policy that the president put out there. They wanted the president to have some independence. So they were a little worried about giving too much power. But of course, Madison ends up working before he becomes president in the legislature. And even he starts pushing the boundaries of there. One of the stories that I found for the book related to George Washington. And James Madison was pushing to get some executive correspondence, some of the letters being written between Washington and foreigners regarding treaty commitments and negotiations for the treaty. And it was Alexander Hamilton who told Washington to push back and say, no, you can't see those. If you have a problem with what we're doing as a president, you need to impeach us. And nobody wanted to take that step against the hero of the country. So in fact, it was establishing a line around the presidency saying we have to be protected in this way. Some of that old history, people have explored that in book-length treatments before and done a better job than I could do. So I just try to bring forward those little stories to set the stage for how these methods of removing a president have evolved over the last 250 years.
And it really is incredible, as always, when you go back into American history and see how many parallels, similarities. We like to think in our generation that we're dealing with things for the first time, and we rarely are. Earlier, you mentioned those 19th century presidents who a lot of us may have lost track of from our school histories. One of the stories you tell that is really compelling and fascinating is about his accidency, and I'm talking about the 10th president, John Tyler, because impeachment is not the only way to get rid of a president. That's a big part of your book, is talking about some of the other ways that presidents have been cast aside. So let's go through some of the adventures and misadventures with John Tyler, who took office a month after being elected on the ticket of William Henry Harrison, who died.
He did. He was the first president to die in office. Just 31 days into office, he died, which is another method I write about. What's one way of getting rid of a president? You wait for them to die. With William Henry Harrison, it was easy because 31 days in, he was dead. With Franklin Delano Roosevelt, it was a little bit harder, but that proved to be the only way Republicans could get him out of office because he kept getting reelected. In the case of Harrison, he died. John Tyler, who was a recent convert to the party, back then called the Whig Party, he came into office, but he was not doing what the Whig Party that put him on the ticket wanted him to do. And very quickly, that became evident. And he had a series of clashes with his own party. The cabinet resigned, only one member staying on. He started vetoing things, which presidents didn't do that often in those days. And Congress started trying to overturn those vetoes. And then you had the party get together and decide he had gone too far, and they literally kicked him out of the party. They said, "We are not going to have you affiliating with us anymore." He was a president without his own party.
That floored me, by the way. I mean, it was just what a story. I don't know how many people know that who don't.
I certainly didn't know it.
Presidents really closely. I mean, that's just shocking to think of any president, no matter how controversial, just all of a sudden the party says, "No, you're done."
They just didn't like him anymore, and they decided, "We're not going to support you. We'd rather nominate anybody else within our party than have you as our representative." So he was gone. The funny thing is, he didn't quite get the message because he thought that he might still be able to get some votes from within the party. That didn't happen. He went back to his previous party, the Democrats, and they laughed at him. Nobody likes a traitor, and they thought he had sold them out. And so he tried to get any way he could to get back on the ticket. It didn't happen. It's a case of a presidency gone wrong and really the system working, because he was doing things outside the normal scope of the presidency, and the others tried to box him in. So the method that he fits the best is rejected by his own party. And we've had that happen many times in history, not as much recently. The most recent example of that, where a president lost the faith of his own party while trying to stay in office, was probably Lyndon Johnson in 1968. He said publicly, "I don't want to run again. I'm going to try to win the war in Vietnam and put my energy into that." But he was doing all the things behind the scenes to show that he still really wanted the nomination, but it just didn't happen. That is a way of getting rid of a president. You just don't renominate him as a party.
Again, we're speaking with David Priest. He's the author of How to Get Rid of a President, History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives. We've obviously had two presidents impeached, Johnson and Clinton. Both were acquitted. And then Richard Nixon, of course, was on the precipice of facing a trial and resigned before that trial could take place. Again, we have so many unknowns with Trump, whether what the evidence will be and whether he would be impeached. But based on what we know right now, assuming that it falls in line with Russia and obstruction of justice and some of the issues that we're talking about, where would that fall on the scale of those previous examples, you think?
Something would have to push him out. I don't see any signs that Donald Trump is just going to leave office voluntarily. Now, Richard Nixon, we should be honest, he did not leave office voluntarily. He was about to be impeached and removed. So in the book, I write that he was removed by impeachment, even though it didn't come to a final vote.
He's sort of the third with an asterisk.
Well, that's right. And Richard Nixon definitely was abusing power. He definitely was harming the institutions of government. But he had served in the military. He had been a senator. He'd been vice president. He is somebody who had been in public service most of his life. And I think somewhere he still loved the country and he still loved the institutions of government, even as he was undermining them. So he resigned rather than go into a battle, which could have been a tight vote in the Senate to remove him. It could have been a conviction in the Senate and him deciding, I don't want to leave. And then it's up to the Secret Service and U.S. Marshals and maybe the military to decide, how do we physically remove a president who doesn't want to get up and walk out? In his case, he resigned and he spared the country at least that. In this case of today, if it were to come to that, we really don't know, because we have a president who has no record of public service, who does not appear to respect the institutions of government in the same way that his predecessors did. We really don't know. Would he try to make a victory out of it by giving a speech saying he tried his hardest and he took it to the people in Washington, but the system is so entrenched that even he, the champion of the people, couldn't save us, so he's taking his ball and going home as a champion? Or would he sit down in the Oval Office, try to get the Secret Service or someone else to say, you're loyal to me, I am still the president, get your weapons out, and if anybody tries to take me out of this chair, you shoot them? I don't know if he would rather leave or if he would rather tear down the very institutions of government around him in an effort to avoid that embarrassing thing of resigning. I just don't know where we are, Eric.
Well, I want to ask you a little bit about the 25th Amendment. You devote considerable time to that in the book. And you mentioned earlier, that was the amendment that was passed in 67?
Yes, 1967.
1967. And of course, there has been prominent mention of the 25th Amendment. You had the anonymous Trump administration New York Times op-ed that received a lot of attention. You also had a separate report that Rod Rosenstein had inquired about the 25th Amendment regarding President Trump. So set the record straight for people who are thinking about that 25th Amendment and how it could or couldn't apply to this president or any other president.
The 25th Amendment, as it relates to presidents leaving office, has two flavors. One is the president himself decides, I am unable to do this right now. And that has actually happened in three different instances. Ronald Reagan once, George W. Bush twice. They knew they were going into surgery. They knew they were going to be unconscious. And so they wrote a temporary passage of power to the vice president. And it was George H.W. Bush in the first case and then Dick Cheney, each of the two subsequent cases. And each time when they got out of the surgery, they signed another letter saying, I'm okay now, and they took back the powers of the presidency. That's in Section 3 of the 25th Amendment, the president self-selecting out of the presidency for a period of time. Section 4 is the one that's more interesting and, frankly, has been the subject of a whole lot of fiction and TV shows, which is what happens if the president says, I'm fine, but the vice president and a majority of the cabinet, and that's how it reads, it has to be the vice president and a majority of either the cabinet or another group that Congress designates, but the default is the cabinet. They have to agree that the president is not able, either physically, mentally, for whatever reason. And at that point, the vice president takes power. Now, there's an appeal process. The president can go to the Congress and say, no, really, I'm fine. And then Congress has to vote. And it's a hard vote, harder even than impeachment and removal. But what you can imagine is a president and a vice president both saying, I'm president. That's a really bad situation to be in. So the 25th Amendment is most likely, the fourth section of forced removal, is most likely to be implemented if, for some reason, the president is unconscious. Let's say a coma. And they can't wake him up. At some point, the vice president and the cabinet say, yes, he is physically unable to do the job. You will be the president until he is able. It's a lot trickier when it comes to something like mental health, because the president can be making erratic decisions by most measures. But if it's just odd policy or an odd way of speaking or tweets that seem out of the norm for presidents in the past, is that a sign of disability or is that just a sign of a personality quirk? If you can't tell the difference, the 25th Amendment is not going to happen, because any vice president who decides you're out of office and I am now president is going to look like they're performing a coup, and they don't want to do that. The only extreme that I can imagine on the mental health side is if the president, not just tweeting oddly or making weird policies, but if the president does something that is just clearly out of touch with reality, like nominating for the new attorney general, nominating a chicken instead of a human being. And in a case
anything's possible in our realm.
In a case like that, I think a vice president and a cabinet could say, yes, maybe they'll consult with doctors, but they'll say, yes, this is a sign that he is not in touch with reality, and we cannot have that man near the nuclear codes in a case like that. Short of that, I just don't think it's going to happen if the president is conscious and willing to look in their eyes and say, no, I'm okay. I've got this.
Again, that's the voice of David Priest. He's speaking with us about how to get rid of a president, history's guide to removing unpopular, unable, or unfit chief executives. As you're going through the 25th Amendment and how it applies, in the book, you explore the case of Woodrow Wilson, which is fascinating. For people who don't remember, in October of 1919, he suffers a stroke, and then for nearly 2 years, he is incapacitated, essentially, and for some of that time, even cabinet members don't know what's going on. So walk us through that a little bit, and could you imagine any modern-day scenario that where you could keep that kind of secret bottled up that long?
It seems unimaginable, and yet I can almost picture it happening again. You're right. Wilson had a devastating stroke. For months, he only had a few people around him who knew what happened. Everybody else was just told, oh, he's exhausted, he's tired, he's remaining in the residence. But people didn't have access to him. The cabinet just didn't even talk to him for a long time. And what happened? The vice president was being urged by some people, you need to find a way to take power. But we didn't yet have the 25th Amendment, so the mechanism wasn't clear how he would do so. But he didn't want anything to do with it, because Wilson's wife and doctor kept coming down from the residence and saying, he's fine. We will pass on the decisions he makes to you. Well, the research that's been done showed they took a few liberties with that, and his wife may have actually been making decisions in his name. Now, she did spend a lot of time with him. She did know how he thought, so she was in a decent place to do so. But she was not elected by the American people. Woodrow Wilson was, and Woodrow Wilson was not able to perform the duties of the presidency, at least for a period of many months, perhaps for the final 2 years of his presidency. How does that relate to the present time? Well, just picture the exact same scenario. Let's say the president suddenly stops traveling, stops making public appearances, and they say he is exhausted and he's in the residence, but he's still signing bills, he's still writing proclamations, but we just don't see him for a while. Vice President Pence says, I'm sorry, can I see the president? And after a few weeks, Melania and the family doctor say, no, you can't. He doesn't want to see anybody. He's too stressed, but he's fine. Trust us. What vice president is going to say, looking into the eyes of his wife and a doctor, no, I'm going to overrule you? It could happen, but it would be hard to imagine there wouldn't be some hesitation on their part, just as there was back 100 years ago.
Well, we are going to take a short break. It will not be 100 years, I promise. Stay with us. We're talking with author David Priest about how to get rid of a president. You're listening to Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. Back on Charlotte Talks with Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and my guest today is David Priest. He's the author of How to Get Rid of a President, History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives, a very timely book. And we're talking about everyone from Madison to Trump and plenty of presidents in between. But I want to ask you a little bit about your previous life, which is you were a CIA officer. You were involved in these intelligence briefings on a daily basis, and one of the people that you briefed was Robert Mueller, who, of course, is the special counsel. You've described him as detail-oriented and a man of integrity, but tell us a little bit about what he's like as a person. We see him every day on TV. He's this enigmatic character. What's it like to be in a room with Robert Mueller?
I can confirm he is a real person. He seems
breaking.
Like, yeah, he does seem like something out of some detective novel from years past, because he's not out there talking. He's not out there making a case for this or that. He's doing his job. He's sitting down as special counsel, weighing the evidence, looking at this momentous issue we're in, and trying to find out what actually happened, with cooperation from some people and a strong lack of cooperation from some other people, but trying to figure out exactly what happened so that anything appropriate can be put forward at that point for others to decide upon. He is not going to be deciding anything. He is simply an investigator who's pulling all this together and then filing charges where they are warranted by the law, or then forwarding a report to, I believe, the attorney general or acting attorney general at the end of it all to say, here are the possible crimes that were committed that we have not put out there for indictments. from my experience with him, seeing him 6 days a week, every morning to start his day by giving him his intelligence briefing, I can tell you as an American, regardless of how you feel about the policies of this president, regardless of how you feel about special counsels in general, everyone should be proud that this man is doing this job because he is rock solid. He is somebody who is focused on the facts, not on spin. He is somebody who's going to treat this the right way, such that regardless of what he comes up with, people who worked with him, some of whom are much more political than I've ever been or ever will be, you've got people who will say, whatever he comes up with, I trust. There's that much integrity in the man.
So when you hear witch hunt, you think what?
I think Richard Nixon, because Richard Nixon was using the same terminology in 1973, 1974, as the Watergate investigation was going on. He was calling it a witch hunt, and he had pretty strong support from his party. And it seemed impossible that the party could turn against him. And then something funny happened. Suddenly, there was strong evidence of obstruction of justice. In his case, tapes were released where you could hear Richard Nixon obstructing justice. And what seemed impossible just weeks earlier became inevitable, as the party said, party doesn't matter. Country matters much more than party. And that's what I think of when I hear witch hunt, is we do have a very strong historical parallel for that, a president denying that anything happened. Now, in this case, we don't know the end game. We don't know whether, in fact, you know, it is a Watergate-type scenario where there is the more direct evidence of obstruction of justice. We just don't know. The person who is most likely to know is Donald Trump, and he's not talking. The second most likely person to know is probably, at this point, Robert Mueller. And he's doing the investigation to find out for sure whether there's something there or not.
So we have had multiple examples and instances of the current president taking shots at the CIA mm-hmm. and the FBI. He revoked the security clearance of former CIA director John Brennan. And we've heard people outraged about those instances, those remarks, that sentiment. As someone who was an employee of the CIA, right. How concerned are you about the morale and the reputation of the men and women who work at the CIA and the FBI in light of what's happened with President Trump?
You know, I'm oddly not that concerned, Eric, about the morale of the people working there now. I'm not going to speak for them, but I know what happened when I was there and politics was going on in the United States. I put my head down and I did my work because my job was not the politics of the United States. My job was to analyze what was happening in foreign governments, to try to figure out what threats there were to the United States from terrorists and others, and to present the very best analysis I could to the President of the United States and others to preserve and defend the Constitution of the United States. That's what we did. Some of us were aware that there were political discussions going on, arguments over tax policy and immigration and you name it, but when it came to our jobs, we didn't care. We put our heads down and we did our work. So I don't think morale is affected that much. But I think on the margins, yes. It's hard to be part of an institution that the president compares to Nazis and not have it feel personal at some level. It's hard to watch the president, as he did right after inauguration, come to CIA headquarters, give his speech in front of the memorial wall, which is as close to a holy space as there is for CIA officers, where we honor the lives of those who gave their lives in service to this country as intelligence officers, and have him give a political speech without acknowledging the sacrifices that were made to preserve the country. That does affect some people at some level, but I don't think it affects them in any way that keeps them from doing their jobs and informing not only the president about the intelligence that relates to national security, but hundreds, thousands of other government officials who are out there doing diplomacy, military action, law enforcement, the other jobs that use intelligence. I think the part that's disturbing is the attack on the institutions of government. And it's not just CIA and FBI. It's essentially anyone who the president perceives as a potential threat or perceives as someone who doesn't agree with him. His instinct is to lash out. He brags about it. You know, I'm a fighter. I punch back. Well, sometimes people aren't punching you, sir. Sometimes they're simply presenting the facts as they see them. And that is an honorable thing. Mm-hmm. Our system is based on making policy based on the facts, not making policy based on a fantasy. And if somebody's telling you some of the things you're saying don't quite match up with what's on the ground, here's what's actually happening, that's not a personal attack. That's not something to punch back for. The institutions aren't made for that. The institutions are made to support the president. The institutions and the agencies aren't really prepared for somebody who who they are working for who is attacking them at the same time. So I think it's a tense time. I think it's a difficult time. But I know people are still doing their jobs to the best of their abilities to try to help every decision maker, including the president, make the best decisions for the country that they can.
Those are the words of David Preece. He's here speaking with us about his new book, How to Get Rid of a President, History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives. We've talked a lot about the book, and we've talked a little bit about your past life. But I do want to ask, when it comes to presidents, you obviously worked under two. You worked under a Republican and a Democrat, George W. Bush and Bill Clinton. I don't know how close or how far away from those two men you were, but what were your general impressions of them as leaders during your time at the CIA?
Yeah, I did have the chance for my first book to interview the four living former presidents, Jimmy Carter and George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. And then, yes, I worked at CIA and the State Department when Bill Clinton was president and when George W. Bush was president. All of them, even though each one of them, I disagreed strongly with some of their policies, and each one of them, I agreed with some of the things they did. But each one of them seemed to want to do the right thing for the country. That is, they had in mind that they had a public stewardship role, and they were doing it. I may disagree with where they went to do that, but I think they wanted to do that for the right reasons, despite their flaws, and all of them had them. I think we tend to think of presidents as these mythical figures, because what happens, we make them into such. When we have a president who does something good in history, judged by historians and the consequences, we build statues. And we make them mythical figures. The Lincoln Memorial in Washington is a wonderful place, and you can look up at Abraham Lincoln and think what he went through to keep this country together. But he was a human being, too. He grew up in squalor. He suffered from crippling depression. Some stories I tell in the new book are things I didn't know about Lincoln and just how much he suffered, probably putting him in the level of disabled presidents. During some of his time in the White House, he should not have been making decisions as president. And yet, he channeled somehow he channeled that depression and that hurt to raise his empathy, to raise his compassion, and become even more of a hero to me than someone who's perfect. It's because he's flawed that he is so good. And that's how I think we need to think about presidents, is not that they should be perfect, not that we should agree with everything they do, but how do they succeed despite their flaws? That's something that I saw when I was working for presidents. That's something that I saw when I was interviewing presidents. Certainly something I found when I was researching the presidents, and something I don't want to lose sight of, because no matter how you feel about this president, who is historically unique in several ways, the institution of the presidency and the institutions of our government have worked pretty well for over 200 years. That's a good track record in history.
If you had a chance to interview this president, what would you like to ask him?
I'd like to ask him, from my first career in intelligence, I would like to ask him how he feels that's working for him, because that's not something that's normally a public conversation, but I care about it. I used to work for it. And he also has a different approach to fact-based reasoning than most presidents. And I would like to know what's still working for you. And we know something is still working for him, because despite most predictions, based on that rocky start with the intelligence community, he is still taking intelligence briefings. Every week, he is getting his president's daily brief, and he is talking to intelligence officers. Almost everything else is off of his schedule now. He would have knocked that off his schedule if he had any severe problem with it. Something is working, and I'd like to know what's working. The other thing I'd like to know is how he actually feels about the institutions of the country, because he can read a prepared speech that says he loves this country and he loves our history and all of this. But when it comes to the actions he takes, sometimes he's undermining the very agencies and departments that are trying to help him, that are trying to give him information and insight to help make policy. And I would like to really dig into that and say, do you understand the impact of what you're doing? If it's deliberate, then that puts it into one bin. But if it's inadvertent, if it's not realizing what that does to the fabric of the country, then maybe there's a different conversation to be had. And I just don't know where he is on that.
I want to ask you, I don't know if you're aware of this, but in 2020, the Republican National Convention will be here in Charlotte. Charlotte, of course, named in honor of King George's wife. So just so you get all your historical perspective while you're in town. But what's your best guess as to who the nominee will be when the RNC is here in a couple of years?
Everything we see now suggests that Donald Trump has received enough support from the party, even the people who privately roll their eyes and say, this is not a president that we thought we'd see. He's received enough support for some of his policies, particularly judicial nominations, that the party overwhelmingly seems to be going along with him. However, We have many cases in history, just not in recent history, where a president who was running for re-election had such a strong primary challenge from within his own party that he lost his own renomination. It's happened many times, mostly in the 19th century. There's no reason that that can't happen again. If you had a strong candidate from within the Republican Party who said, I'll follow most of those policies that y'all like, but I'm not going to do those things that you don't like and those things that are alienating a lot of Americans. The percentages of people voting for the Republican Party that we saw in the last midterm election were certainly down. And it's the kind of thing that a lot of Republican Party regulars look at and say, is there any way of correcting this? Well, there is one way of correcting it, and that's having an actual open discussion going into the next convention, maybe having it on the floor here in Charlotte, of what do we want people to see when they see the Republican Party? Do we want them to see a cult around Donald Trump, or do we want them to see the policies that many of them support, but somebody who doesn't have some of the negatives that have come with that? That is probably a healthy conversation, regardless of where you are on the political spectrum. You want to see two functioning political parties. So that would be something that would be nice to see, but I'm not sure if we're going to see it, because Donald Trump has a way, as he showed in the last campaign, of taking out his political opponents one by one. As they all fight each other, he takes them out one by one, and he's the man who ended up on top.
Yeah, he did. And going back to the book and those 19th century presidents, first of all, I think that you point out, for those of us who may have forgotten, that that was a pretty lousy run of presidents there for a while.
There's a reason why we had a whole bunch of one-term presidents.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But clearly, as you say, those presidents were gotten rid of mostly by the parties just not wanting to continue on. So I think in your previous answer, you're saying that this is not beyond the realm of seeing this, not only with Trump, but in the future, that maybe every president or most presidents are not two-term presidents.
That's right. We are in a historical odd period right now, Eric. We're coming off of three consecutive two-term presidents. We had Bill Clinton, we had George W. Bush, we had Barack Obama, all of whom were reelected and then, because of changes to the Constitution, can't run again. The last time we had three consecutive two-term presidents was Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe right near the beginning. It doesn't happen that often. This is the oddity. More often, what will happen is someone will run again, like George H.W. Bush did in 1992, and there's something in the country that's desirous of change, and they move that person out. That is more of the norm. Now, some political scientists are looking at questions like, has something changed within the party system or some incentives where that is actually more likely now to have a person who always runs for two terms? Maybe so, maybe not. But ultimately, it doesn't come down to party systems. It comes down to people. It comes down to what people vote at a ballot box. And if there is a strong primary challenger who, again, has some of the policy positives for Republicans of Donald Trump, but not some of the personality negatives, then the people get to vote. That's the beauty of our country. We've been through a lot of bad presidents. We've been through a lot of bad times. We've even been through a civil war. But we're still here. Something in this system is working. And I'd like to think it's because we can remove presidents without having a civil war and violence every time it happens. We have a system and we move on as a country even as the leaders move on.
I want to close. We just have a little bit of time left, but I want to close by asking you, as you're digging into all this history, you've now done two books. Have you thought about what you'd like to explore next, and do you think it will involve presidents?
I think it will, because as you keep reading about the presidents of this country, you learn about the deeper cultural history of the country. You learn about the institutions around the presidency. And I think it's a fascinating way to look at us, to realize the times change and our leaders change with us. Do they lead? Do they follow those changes? That's a fun story to follow. Plus, you get a little bit more than caricature then. Then you don't just get a picture of somebody on a wall. You get the story of a real human being, the struggles they went through, and it reminds us that no matter how dark the times are, we're going to get through this.
Well, David Priest, those are good words to close with. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Eric.
That was David Priest. He's the author of the new book, How to Get Rid of a President, History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives. Check it out now. Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins on WFAE.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.